This is Wisconsin Today. The universities of Wisconsin has a lot going on these days, with a recent request for a funding increase in the next two-year state budget at the top of that list.
Plus, a review of UW programs around the state just wrapped up, and low enrollment majors could face cuts. Also, members of a committee formed by state lawmakers have brought back a suggestion to split UW-Madison from the system as a whole.
Universities of Wisconsin President Jay Rothman is with us now for a look at those stories and more. Jay, welcome back to the show.
Good morning. It's good to be with you today.
Lot to talk about. Let's start with that budget request, $855 million increase. Make the case for that boost.
Well, I think we start with a proposition that Wisconsin is currently 43rd out of 50 states in terms of its public support for its university system. The $855 million over the 2 years of the biennium would get Wisconsin to the average or median level. We think that's a reasonable ask to continue to ensure affordability and accessibility for Wisconsinites to our 13 great universities.
Earlier this week, we talked to Republican State Senator Eric Wimberger, who will serve again on the Joint Finance Committee, big part of any budget request. Here's a bit of what he had to say about that request.
Personally, I think the UW needs to get focused on what's important. Expanding, just so you can say that you spend as much as somebody else is, I don't know, Not is a non sequitur.
So skeptical of ranking state by state budget funding, say, hey, what are you giving us for the money we're giving you?
I think we start with affordability and accessibility. One of the things we have in our budget request is a tuition promise, and this would allow students of lower socioeconomic means or even the middle class to benefit after grants and everything else in order to take tuition off the table in terms of people attending our universities. Universities of Wisconsin we are focused on serving the state and helping Wisconsin win the war for talent. We've set a very aggressive goal in terms of increasing the number of graduates from our universities. And those are the future nurses and data scientists and engineers and teachers. And that list goes on and on. If we don't produce those graduates, the jobs that the great employers of Wisconsin are creating today are going to go unfilled. Those jobs are going to move outside of the state. And to the extent that they can't be moved, people are going to get suboptimal service and a quality of service, not because the people aren't good, but they're serving too many people.
Staying with the state legislature, some members of this Legislative Council Study Committee looking at the universities are bringing back this notion of splitting UW-Madison off from the rest of the system, saying, hey, it is its own unique duck. It is more, it needs to run itself, and then it'll be better for everybody. You, I believe, are not a fan of that notion.
You know, I don't think it makes a great deal of sense to be candid. And I think Chancellor Mnuchin and I have said the same thing. I know Governor Evers has said the same thing. And if you think about it, I believe we are better together. The 13 universities work well together. There's a lot of collaboration among our 13 universities. And you think about just a dairy innovation hub or a freshwater collaborative, our work among our multiple universities, and to create a separate bureaucracy to oversee UW-Madison, and then creating additional competition between our publicly funded institutions of higher education in the state makes no sense to me. And then there is extraordinary administrative costs associated with that. We get the benefit of purchasing power. We get the benefit of being able to have one common, and we are working toward having one common HR and finance structure, replacing an antiquated system that's currently in place. If we were to separate Madison from that, that system would have to be replicated in two different places, and it would be a lot more costly. And I think for all of those reasons, the notion of splitting off Madison is not a wise one.
The universities of Wisconsin have been doing a big review, an outside review of how the system works. One of the big takeaways from the latest findings of that review, a closer look at low enrollment programs, majors and other programs at campuses around the state. What do you see there? What are some of the changes you might see coming?
Yeah, and I think we need to step back a little bit. We did brought in a third party to review us because we wanted to make sure that our universities thrive and are vibrant for future generations. So that was really the starting point. As it relates to program array, I mean, that is always evolving. And if you think about today, we educate nearly 40% of our graduates are in the STEM or healthcare fields. That's up 30% in the last 10 years. So you think of this natural evolution of programs being needed to being created to serve the demand in Wisconsin, and then some programs are going to be lower enrolled, and we need to look at those programs. And just to give you some point of reference, over the last 5 years, we have closed or discontinued over 100 programs among the universities of Wisconsin. So this is an ongoing process. I think what the third-party assessor came in and suggested is that there be a little bit more oversight from the Board of Regents in that process. This is still going to take place on our campuses. This is not going to be top-down driven, but I think just to provide that a higher level of visibility for our Board of Regents. Right now, our Board of Regents have a process by which they approve programs. And I think what will ultimately flow from this is a process by which the board will review program discontinuances and program suspensions. I think it's all healthy governance, but I don't think it's going to change the world a great deal because this is an area that has always evolved. This is not something new, and program array is not static. It evolves over time.
Something we're seeing in the news today, actually, Jay, a growing list of campuses around the country warning international students, saying, hey, get back here. Even if classes haven't started yet, get here before inauguration day because of possible travel bans with the new presidential administration. Are you keeping an eye on this? Are you doing things to help international students at the UW system in an uncertain transition time?
You know, I think our international students have certainly gotten that information from a variety of sources, including us in specific communications. And I think it's an area that we have to watch moving forward about what the incoming administration may be. But I think our international students are well aware of the potential challenges and will react accordingly.
Jay, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
I appreciate it. Thanks very much. Have a great day.
That's Jay Rothman, president of the Universities of Wisconsin. As a note, WPR is a service of UW-Madison. Do you have thoughts or concerns about the future of UW campuses around the state? Maybe a personal experience to share? You can email us, wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Your questions, your comments could drive future coverage.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, meet a Wisconsin researcher who is using sound to track down insects that eat crops.
In that big sound file, we can start to tease apart, are the insects feeding? Are they not feeding? If we separate out those crunches, we can start to say how many insects are out there.
That's just ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today.
That sound you're hearing is an aphid eating a soybean plant in southern Wisconsin. As the small pear-shaped insect eats the plant, it causes damage and could even kill it.
The USDA estimates that between 20 and 40% of global crop production is lost to pests annually. But UW-Madison entomologist Emily Bick may have a solution.
She invented the insect eavesdropper, which uses microphones to detect and spy on pests as they eat and cause damage.
Emily runs the original digital entomology lab at UW-Madison and is an assistant professor of precision pest ecology and extension specialist for field and forage crops. Emily, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
All right. What kind of things can we learn, big picture, by listening to insects as they munch away on our crops?
Part of the reason this type of sensor exists and other sensors like this are coming onto the market is because we have some really limited ways to learn about insects, right? Often I work in agriculture. We often use a sweep net or a butterfly net with like an extra thick canvas bag and go out and count. But there are a heck of a lot more insects and there aren't that many people that can go out and identify them. So the thought with this is for especially the insects that are hard to find, ones that are eating, boring down the stalk of a corn plant, feeding feeding on the root zone, those borers, the root feeding insects, where it takes a heck of a lot of labor. You have to dig up the plant, bring a butcher's knife. You can just directly hear if they're there or if they're not. You can then use some machine learning algorithms. Some very smart folks, smarter than me, developed these things to then tell piece apart what types of insects, what species are you listening to?
Now, we're talking to microphones now, and with my experience with microphones, I think this has got to be a challenge because you're trying to record what I imagine is a very, very quiet sound where, say, the wind blowing through corn stalks is going to be much louder. So what does it take to get a microphone onto, say, a corn stalk or whatever plant that's going to hear and make out the details of these insects?
Yeah, so these are kind of different than these air microphones that we have that I'm talking into right now. These are clip-on contact microphones or guitar mics or piezoelectric microphones. So it's basically a little brass disc that has an electrode attached to it. And when the disc vibrates, as in when the corn stalk is vibrating from the wind or a bite sound or a rain event, right, that is then translated through the electrode into an electrical signal. And then that raw signal can start to be teased apart. Does it sound like an actual bite? Does it sound like a person is stuck in through a straw on this thing? Or is it just some wind and rain sounds?
Well, let's get a sense of what this sounds like. You supplied us with the sound. Now, this is a northern corn rootworm, I assume, munching away at the corn's roots.
I'll
go by the name here.
It is. It's a Diabrotica species.
Well, here's a listen. All right, so I'm hearing that background hum, that baseline hum, and then those clicking noises, I imagine, are our foes here. I was going to say our friends. Our foes, the northern corn rootworm.
They are, and there's actually two separate things that are happening over here. There's both a crunching, which is what we were getting in the middle of that sound bite, but also some tapping. So corn rootworms, in fact, anything in the Diabrotica species, uses its maxillary palps to literally bang on the corn plant, and they have chemoreceptors, so they can tell, you know, is there a lot of sugar in that corn plant? Are there kind of antifeedants or secondary metabolites, chemicals that the insect doesn't like? Is it the right time of day to be feeding? Even though they're under the ground, they actually feed at very specific times in the day. So in that big sound file, we can start to tease apart, are the insects feeding? Are they not feeding? If we separate out those crunches, we can start to say how many insects are out there.
And how big? I mean, we know that pests eat a lot of our crops around the world. The northern corn rootworm, for example, how big a problem is this?
So in the Midwest, in the Corn Belt, this has been called the billion-dollar pest.
Oh, wow.
So this is a serious economic issue. And one of the issues with this particular pest and this strategy is we don't really have a rescue treatment right now. So all we can do is say, okay, is it going to be a bad year? Is it going to be a good year? And then try to steer our corn plants for next year for this particular insect.
But something you mentioned is that part of what you're doing here isn't just, okay, are they there, but when are they active? Is that part of the hope that if we could say, okay, they eat at midnight or they eat at dawn or whatever, that can start to point the road to solutions?
Absolutely. So that time of day is really, really important. When you have a pesticide or a biological control agent, a good bug, let's say, that predates or parasitizes that bad bug, that pest, you have this major piece of interaction time where that pesticide or that good bug needs to be at the right place at the right time. And if you don't know when that right time is, you could be expressing, let's say, BT, cryogenic protein type thing. You could be expressing that protein that's insecticidal at the wrong time so that the insect just won't encounter it.
So I would think maybe one possible outcome is, okay, well, if I want to make sure I'm getting these pests, I'm going to spray 3 times in a day, or I'm going to do more applications. If we can pinpoint the right time, does that mean ultimately we hope to use maybe fewer pesticides?
That's exactly what we're going after, more sustainable growing of food. And when you say fewer pesticides, I should also note that organic orchards, organic agroecosystems, they tend to use pesticides too, but they also, those pesticides tend to not be as effective, which means that bettering that timing or bettering that spacing, or even that saying, is this pest here or not, is really, really critical in that go, no-go decision-making process.
We're talking to Emily Bick, entomology professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, inventor of the insect eavesdropper. All right, you brought an eavesdropper with you. It's a I don't know, if I saw this on a wall at a house, I might say it's kind of a big doorbell or something just from the outside casing. Describe it to us.
So we've 3D printed a case on the outside. You can look through the window on the case and see the screen and have some buttons, have some control over what's going on there. On the very back is a way to clip this case or this insect eavesdropper onto a stake or onto a tree or something. There's something grippy on the backside. But when you open the box, when you take the lid off, what you can see is a little Raspberry Pi or a computer on
a chip.
That's
a computer chip model, yeah.
Exactly. It's like two thumbtack boxes put together. That's about the right size. And that fully formed computer, although it's a little bit on the slow on the processing side, what it does is it says start, stop, and save. So it's starting the program. Attached to this Raspberry Pi is some storage. I can show you over here. We've got a storage place, a USB hub, and then four contact microphones, mm-hmm. as well as a way to power it through either solar or through a normal plug.
Yeah, we focused on that corn rootworm, but you're working with places, not just in Wisconsin, I think, around the world. Can you tell us about some of the places that you're either currently working on or that are interested in the work you're doing on different kinds of crops?
Yeah, a postdoc in the Netherlands by the name of Sam Edwards, he's clipping on these microphones onto corn plants and looking at fall armyworm, which is a U.S. native invasive pest. It's native to the U.S. It's invasive across the world. And he's looking at some viruses. So he's infecting these armyworms with viruses. And he's able to differentiate, hey, look, is this virus taking? Is it not? What's the viral load? And I say he's testing this out right now. But he's essentially looking and seeing how the behavior of this insect is changing in response to that literal biocontrol virus in this case.
And how about closer to home? Are you working with farms or farm operations in our neck of the woods?
Yeah, so we right now are really focused on researchers. So we're doing a fair amount at Arlington or Research Station, as well as West Madison Research Station at UW-Madison. So those are kind of our farming operations. But closer to home, we handed this out to Brian McCormick's group. He's the department head at KSU, Kansas State University. And he's taking a look at labeling a whole bunch of soybean pests. So soybean aphid, soybean gall midge, potentially, trying to see what's going on within the soybeans.
Is there a hope that within X number of years, everyday farmers, people who own farms would say, yeah, I'm going to pick up a couple insect eavesdroppers, see what I got going on?
The hope is either farmers or really it might be crop consultants, that this type of sensor, instead of having to destructively take apart your crop, ruin that particular part of the field, this type of sensor might be able to be clipped on instead of through the Raspberry Pi computer on a chip, just through Bluetooth through your phone, and then folks can tell what's going on in their field. Now, alternatively, it could be run as a network, right? So we monitor all of these sentinel corn crops around the U.S. We have sentinel chicken cages that we monitor for flu-type viruses. But instead of having a person go out and check once a week or every other week, we might be able to do this autonomously with these types of sensors.
Now, looking at this insect eavesdropper here, it sounds pretty high-tech, but it sounds like you've been working to get components that aren't particularly expensive. That's part of the strategy here?
That is. We really know that accessibility is important. So at this point, this box costs about $120. We're hoping eventually this type of thing will cost about $15 a microphone, so about half that. Part of it is we're buying these off-the-shelf components, but price is a huge issue. So we're trying to make this as accessible to folks as we possibly can.
So what's the next big stage in your research that you'd like to fast forward and find the results right now?
Yes. Density. Trying to quantify the numbers of insects on a plant is the top question that we have. And that's coming straight out of my lab. The reason we care about those numbers is we use the density of insects or the numbers of insects feeding on a plant at a given time as a way to make economic decisions. So we got this fantastic grant from the USDA, NEFA, Data Science for Food and Agricultural Systems. This is in collaboration with Brian McCormick's group at KSU to try to see if we could figure out how many insects are actively feeding on a plant at once so that we can get a better sense of those numbers that we need for decisions.
When it comes to insect threats to crops, are there new ones emerging, or do we have just kind of the usual suspects that are already always working with?
European corn borer is the insect that was once old. It's now new again. It bores down the stalk of a corn plant. It can feed directly on the kernels. And as soon as GMO BT was introduced, that particular insect was significantly less of a problem. So we in Wisconsin don't really have an issue with European corn borer these days. However, resistance has been reported in Canada. It's been reported in Connecticut. We were part of a study this past summer trying to see if it's in the state of Wisconsin as well. And that's the real question, right? So is that pest about to make a major resurgence due to these resistance genes? But at the same time, we have something called soybean gall midge, which hasn't yet been found in the state of Wisconsin. Actually, hasn't been found in Wisconsin's borders yet, but it has been devastating places like Illinois and Iowa's soybeans.
Does it feel like you're in this evolutionary arms race? Sometimes we come up with a way to beat this pest and give it a surprisingly short amount of time to evolve a resistance?
Not only are we in that evolutionary arms race, we're also trying to do more with less, right? The Environmental Protection Agency, that EPA, is not certifying pesticides or new GMO traits as fast as it used to. It's putting up a few more barriers, a few more restrictions, you know, for good or for bad. Some folks will find these really useful. Some folks will find this not useful at all, right? But basically, it's taking tools out of the toolbox for farmers. And because of that, we need to do more with better data. We need to do more with less.
And this, that brings us back around to the insect eavesdropper. Is that one of the primary goals, to help people in part by tracking that timing of when insects are eating, do more with less?
Yes, exactly. So if we know exactly when and where the insects show up, then we can precisely target those insects. We can do that true precision agriculture approach. Versus right now, we tend to spray on a calendar, spray on some limited scouting data, just because scouting is so cost effective and labor intensive, and really trained labor intensive as well.
Emily, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Emily Bick runs the Original Digital Entomology Lab at UW-Madison and is the inventor of the insect eavesdropper. Bick is an assistant professor of precision pest ecology and extension specialist for field and forage crops.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a Madison perfume maker who made a signature scent for our state says smell is key to our human experience.
It's really connected to your memory brain. It's connected to your emotion brain. You can utilize it as a superpower.
Aromas of Wisconsin, that conversation coming up from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Earlier this month, Miller High Life served up a limited edition cologne.
The Milwaukee-based beer company made a cologne that takes all the flavors and aromas of a local dive bar and bottles it up in a spritz.
It's appropriately named Dive Barfume, combining notes of cedarwood and patchouli to evoke a bar counter. A chempaka blossom is added to mimic the Miller Life beer.
To learn about perfume making in Wisconsin, we turn to Christy Moe, founder and president of Zotica Perfumery in Madison. Christy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. It is amazing to be here after listening to you for so long.
Thank you. What are your thoughts, first, on the release of Miller's Dive Barfum?
I think that's an appropriate reaction. Laughter. I love it. It's so novel. It's fun. You know, perfume and cologne in general, like, it purely exists for our pleasure and for our entertainment. Why not have fun with it? They clearly know their customer. They know their likes and their dislikes. And this is something that I think, for the ultimate fan, they will eat it up.
Well, I hope not, but does the scent, though, does its creation prove that while maybe one scent might be off-putting to one person, another person might think it's really wonderful?
This is true. I mean, scent is such a personal experience because it plays directly to your emotions and to your memories. So I feel like for their customer base who has some amazing memories in those type of settings, right? For them, it's going to be something that symbolizes an important part of their life and something that they want to express about themselves.
We are talking about the perfume industry in Wisconsin with recent news that Miller Brewing Company has made a cologne called Dive Barfum. And our guest is Christy Moe, founder of a perfumery in Madison. Christy, let's turn to your scent called Eau de Wisconsin that you created in 2020. How do perfume makers go about capturing the scent of a place or even an idea?
Well, I can speak to me personally. So for me personally, I tried to capture the scent of Wisconsin through a very metaphysical, esoteric process that involved looking at the birth date, essentially, of Wisconsin, when it was founded, and using that birth date and then taking that into a sky map and seeing where all the planets were at the day that Wisconsin was founded as a state and accepted into the Union, and then using our zodiac fragrances to create a layered perfume.
You've been around scents for so long. What is your most interesting scent profile that you've ever come across in your work?
That's a good question. Interesting scent profile. For me, like the most interesting scent profiles is certain things that happen in nature, like petrichor, like the different scent of like when it rains. Like being able, we love that smell, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And being able to capture that in a scent profile so that we can recreate it and enjoy it and have it in a bottle sitting on our dresser and be able to smell that at any time. Mm-hmm. I'm really big on aromatherapy and creating scent profiles that are triggering emotions in a very positive way, whether that's, you know, making us feel happy or relaxed or excited or, you know, sensual for a partner. You know, all of those good emotions is what I really get excited about. And I, because that's the most impact that I can have personally in my line of work. The fact that you can smell, you can spray a scent on your skin and improve your day, like that's fascinating to me.
In your line of work, Wisconsin and the Midwest may not be known as a perfume capital or
sure.
among perfume makers. Are there makers in our state, though, or region whose work you're excited about?
It's very hard to make a good perfume. So there's not a lot of indie perfumers out there. And when you do come across a perfumer, there is a concentration of perfumers that are, say, like on the East Coast or even on the West Coast. And the reason why is because the oil manufacturers are there. So it's easier to be close to those resources. So it is very rare to find perfumers outside of those locations. There's interesting, a perfumer who's originally from Wisconsin, her family is still here. She now lives in Arizona. But she and I have become very close friends, and I love her work. Her brand name is Kayla Gray, but her name is Kelly Koosman, and she does great work. And we're so aligned in being able to create these scent profiles that use a limited amount of necessary chemicals, because we're both very aware of what certain chemicals like phthalates and parabens, how they interact with our body, and it's not always good. And so both her and I come from a same value base. So I really do admire her work, and her blends are beautiful.
If someone comes to you and says, Christy, I don't do scents. I don't like to have scents on anything. Can you persuade them?
Absolutely, because I was that person. I was a person that wanted to avoid scent at all costs because I'm so sensitive to it and it would trigger headaches most of the time. But the thing is that scent is such part of our human experience. Like the more you learn about that and how impactful and positive it can be, you can utilize it as a superpower. So when you are able to have a repertoire of scent that doesn't trigger for you, that you can actually enjoy, it's life-changing because you can suddenly be applying the scent on your body and conjure up these memories from, you know, decades ago, memories of loved ones that
may no longer be with us, right?
Like a mom.
Sure, yeah. Or capturing a memory for future recall, capturing your wedding day, for example, capturing, you know, the time that you found out that you're pregnant or the birth of your child. So utilizing scent as a superpower and as you know, part of your human experience is very important.
How about we try some scents?
Yes.
Yeah. So what should we do first here?
Well, should we review Sagittarius?
Let's go for Sagittarius.
Sag season right now.
And so here on the display, you have this, all of the zodiac symbols in kind of going around all the constellations. All right, let me take a smell here. Now, I do smell the fruitiness coming through. Strawberry, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Good nose.
Yes. So the fruit hits me at first, and then the scent might start to settle?
Yes. So in perfumery, there's something called top, middle, and bottom notes. Mm-hmm. What you're smelling initially are those top notes. They're top notes because they're the most volatile. They're the lightest weight oils, so they literally will evaporate faster. Mm-hmm. And so they hit your nose first. And then as it dries down, you'll experience the other notes that are in the formula. So it'll slowly change over to more warm notes of vanilla, and some cinnamon is in there as well.
Cinnamon, and then the vanilla, and those coming in a little bit later in the fragrance. Oh. And so as you go through the course of your day, you might find that it changes as the day wears on.
Yes, absolutely. So our perfumes have anywhere from 50 to 100 oils, and that's pretty standard for most perfume formulations, unless you're doing like a very simple essential oil blend. So the idea here is with a fine fragrance, you do want it to change over time, because that is showing that the way it was constructed has all these oils in it, and it's giving you that experience throughout the day. And then also, like, as you apply that perfume or cologne on your skin, it's going to interact with your own chemistry and really personalize it. So it's going to smell unique to you versus like out of the bottle or someone else as well.
And so for Sagittarius, what characteristics, went into this formulation?
It's interesting because it's not what I think a Sagittarius should smell like or should like. It's all based on 3 years of blind scent studies that I did with women all across the U.S. And what I found is that there's patterns that were happening. So Sagittarius women were consistently choosing the same or similar scent notes over other ones. And what they liked was different than, say, like what a Leo or what a Virgo would like. So I literally based the formula on the Sagittarius women's scent preferences.
Huh. You crowdsourced it.
I crowdsourced it. Exactly.
Christy, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me be here today.
Christy Moe is founder and president of Zotica Perfumery, and she talked with us about Miller High Life's new Barfume Cologne and the business of perfume making in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.